Nemoto presents pioneers of psychology and psychiatry. Carl Rogers, The Listening Revolution. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 29 minutes. Chicago, 1953. A cramped second-floor counseling room on Drexel Avenue, half a block from the University of Chicago campus, has become a sanctuary of quiet amid the bustling city. The afternoon sun filters through a narrow window, illuminating motes of dust that hang in the still air. Two people sit facing each other in plain wooden chairs. No couch, no desk between them, nothing to distract from the human encounter. On one chair, a young man in his 20s leans forward, elbows on his knees, head bowed. He struggles to find words, his voice low and taut with shame. He's a war veteran turned student, and life off the battlefield has been bewildering. Nights bring nightmares. Days bring a sense of disconnection from everyone around him. On the other chair sits Carl Rogers, quietly attentive. Rogers's posture is relaxed yet engaged, his hands loosely folded in his lap, his gaze warm and steady behind steel-rimmed glasses. He nods gently as the young man haltingly describes his feelings of anger and guilt that won't let him sleep. Rogers does not interrupt or offer any quick fixes. He listens deeply, actively, as if nothing else in the world exists except the struggling story unfolding in the space between them. The young man pauses, afraid he's said too much. He risks a glance up and meets Rogers' eyes. Instead of judgment, he finds understanding. Rogers mirrors back some of the man's words in a soft, affirming tone. You feel lost, like the world moved on without you, and it hurts so much. At this, the student's face crumples and tears well up. He had braced for a lecture or a diagnosis, some confirmation that he was indeed broken beyond repair. But those simple words from Rogers, reflecting his inner turmoil so accurately, unlock something. In the shabby little room with peeling paint, a grown man begins to cry, releasing grief and relief in equal measure. Rogers remains present with him, leaning in slightly, his own eyes moist now. There is no shock or pity on his face, only genuine care. After a few minutes, the young man takes a trembling breath and continues speaking, more freely now, as if assured that here, at last, someone truly hears him. Outside on the street below, a streetcar clatters by, and a vendor shouts, hawking hot dogs. But inside the therapy room, those sounds barely register. The real noise, the storm that raged inside one man's soul, has found a safe harbor and is quieting at its own pace. In that simple exchange of understanding, a quiet revolution is taking place. Where once the role of a therapist was to probe, advise, or direct, Rogers is doing something radically different. He is trusting in the healing power of empathy and acceptance. He did not arrive at this approach overnight or by following convention. Carl Rogers's journey toward this moment began in an unexpected setting, a farm in the American heartland. Born in 1902 in Oak Park, Illinois, Rogers grew up amid rolling fields and a devoutly religious household. His parents were strict Protestants, earnest and hardworking, instilling in their six children the values of duty, piety, and self-discipline. As a boy, Rogers rose before dawn to do farm chores and spent long afternoons with his nose in books when other children might be at play. He was intensely shy and often kept his rich, imaginative life to himself. The Rogers home, while loving in its own way, was not a place for open emotional display or fanciful indulgence. Curiosity sometimes bumped against doctrine. When young Carl developed an interest in science and reading beyond the approved religious texts, he learned to pursue knowledge quietly, without making waves. This inward-turning tendency meant that as a child, he often felt alone, confiding mainly in his diary. He later remembered that he did not have the kind of childhood where feelings flowed freely. Instead, he learned to keep most of his thoughts and doubts to himself, hidden under a polite, obedient demeanor. In 1922, as a tall, bespectacled 20-year-old, Carl Rogers left the familiar confines of home for a voyage across the ocean that would forever expand his perspective. He had been selected as one of a handful of American college students to attend an international Christian youth conference in Beijing, China. For a sheltered Midwestern youth, the trip was a revelation. During long weeks aboard the ship and the days spent in China, Rogers engaged with peers from many nations and faiths. He listened to heated debates about theology, world peace, and the meaning of understanding across cultures. One evening in Nanking, he found himself part of a small group discussion with young people from China, India, Europe, and beyond. As lantern light flickered on a circle of earnest faces, Rogers felt something shift in him. He realized that his own upbringing had given him one set of beliefs, but others had their own deeply held truths born from different soil. The conclusion was both humbling and liberating. There was more than one way to think, to live, to seek truth. On the long journey back to Illinois, Rogers pondered these experiences. He returned a little less sure of the theological certainties he had inherited, and a lot more curious about how individuals come to hold the values and feelings they do. This openness to new ideas would soon steer him away from the ministry, which had been his planned path, and toward the still young field of psychology. Rogers pursued graduate studies in psychology at Columbia University's Teachers College in New York City during the late 1920s and early 1930s. There he was exposed to the leading thinkers of the day and, perhaps more importantly, to the practice of therapy as it was then done. At the time, Freudian psychoanalysis dominated the clinical scene with its authoritative stance. The doctor was the expert who probed the patient's unconscious, interpreted their dreams, and pronounced diagnoses. Another approach, behaviorism, was on the rise as well, reducing learning and behavior to formulaic stimulus and response patterns. Rogers respected the insights of Freud and the logic of behaviorists like John Watson, but something about both approaches felt incomplete to him. Working as an intern at a child guidance clinic, he met troubled children and anxious parents who did not seem to fit neatly into any theory. He found that simply imposing interpretations on them, telling them what their problem was, often made them shut down rather than improve. Meanwhile, he became intrigued by the ideas of an unorthodox therapist named Otto Rank, who had broken away from Freud. Rank emphasized the here-and-now relationship between therapist and client and believed in the individual's capacity for growth. These ideas planted a seed in Rogers' mind. Perhaps therapy could be less about digging for distant causes and more about nurturing a person's immediate potential. After earning his PhD, Rogers began his professional work in Rochester, New York, in the mid-1930s at a child guidance clinic associated with the Rochester Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. Here he encountered children battered by life, victims of neglect, abuse, and poverty, as well as parents at wit's end. The prevailing method was for experts to assess and advise, to be directive. Rogers diligently tried to apply the standard techniques he had learned, offering interpretations of children's behavior through psychoanalytic concepts or dispensing practical advice to parents on how to manage their unruly kids. But many of these families cycled in and out with little lasting change. Over time, Rogers noticed a pattern. The more he simply listened and conveyed real concern, the more these troubled youths and weary parents seemed to find their own answers. One case in particular stuck with him. A distraught mother came in with her sullen, withdrawn son who had been stealing small items from school. Instead of lecturing the boy or immediately pathologizing him, Roger sat down with him alone and started by asking gently what he felt about the situation. At first, the child mumbled nothing but stock phrases, "I don't know. I guess I'm just bad." Yet Rogers persisted with patient empathy, reflecting the boy's feelings of confusion and fear without judgment. Gradually, the child opened up. It turned out he felt desperately lonely and angry after his father had abandoned the family, and stealing was his way of getting attention. When Rogers later brought the mother in and helped her truly hear what her son was experiencing, both of them ended up in tears, holding each other. It was a breakthrough moment. Rogers had done very little by traditional standards, offered no grand interpretation, administered no reward or punishment. Yet by simply facilitating a safe space for understanding, a fractured relationship began to heal. Encounters like this were epiphanies for Rogers. By the late 1930s, he had developed a quietly revolutionary idea. Perhaps the therapist's role was not to direct or solve, but to create a relationship in which the client could discover solutions for themselves. It was a humble role, almost like being a midwife to the client's own self-understanding. This ran against the grain of the expert-driven ethos of the time. Nonetheless, Rogers's conviction grew with each success he witnessed when he dared to listen more and prescribe less. In 1940, he finally got the chance to share his emerging approach with the wider world. At a professional meeting in Minnesota, Rogers presented a talk describing how he worked with troubled children and adults. He spoke plainly, avoiding the dense psychiatric jargon popular in that era. He described how, in his sessions, he would try to see the world through the client's eyes and respond to what the client was feeling rather than jumping to conclusions. As he explained this, he noticed a sea of puzzled faces in the audience. A few eyebrows arched in skepticism. A well-known psychoanalyst in attendance reportedly crossed his arms in disapproval. To those steeped in traditional therapeutic doctrine, what Rogers described sounded like no therapy at all. No analysis? No diagnosis? It seemed heretical. One critic muttered that Rogers's method was undisciplined, unsystematic, just talking. Rogers, soft-spoken but earnest, calmly defended his experience. When given the right environment of acceptance, he argued, clients can and will explore their own issues and often come to profound insights and positive changes without being prodded or coerced. By 1945, Rogers had moved to Chicago, where he was invited to establish a counseling center at the university. He and a team of like-minded colleagues set up shop in a modest, somewhat rundown house on Drexel Avenue. The atmosphere there was far from the plush psychoanalytic offices adorned with couches and shelves of European tomes. Instead, each counseling room was sparse and utilitarian, just two chairs and perhaps a small table with a glass of water. What they lacked in decor, Rogers made up for in vision. He began formally training students in this new approach, which was by now being called client-centered therapy. The very term was a statement. It was the client, not the therapist, who was at the heart of the process. This approach required a revolutionary flipping of assumptions. The client was not a passive patient on a couch receiving the wisdom of a doctor. The client was an active, autonomous person striving toward growth, and the therapist's job was to support and not hinder that natural tendency. The quiet revolutionary from the Midwest was being noticed. In 1947, at just 45 years old, Rogers was elected president of the American Psychological Association. It was an honor he accepted with some astonishment, the once-shy farm boy now at the helm of American psychology. But Rogers saw it less as a personal triumph and more as a chance to advocate for a more humane vision of therapy on a national stage. At first, the academic community watched this experiment with a mix of curiosity and skepticism. Chicago in the late 1940s was a hotbed for psychology, behaviorists studying rats in mazes, psychoanalysts interpreting dreams, and into this mix Rogers introduced something seemingly simple, two people talking openly. But Rogers was not content to rely on anecdotes to prove his point. Ever the empiricist, he leveraged new technology to bring objectivity into the therapy room. He had sessions recorded on reel-to-reel audio tape, a novel and somewhat daring practice at the time. With recordings, conversations could be reviewed, studied, and even quantified. Rogers and his team developed ways to measure therapeutic progress, such as tracking changes in how clients describe themselves over the course of therapy. They devised questionnaires and used the QSORT technique to see if a client's real self-perception grew closer to their ideal self after therapy, a sign of growing self-acceptance and congruence. By subjecting his methods to research, Rogers was gathering evidence that his gentle, non-directive approach yielded real, tangible improvements in people's lives. Clients reported reduced anxiety, better relationships, and a greater sense of self-worth. These were outcomes that could be observed not just in what the clients said about themselves, but in follow-up reports from families and workplaces. Bit by bit, Rogers was proving to the skeptics that just talking, if done with empathy and genuineness, was hardly a trivial thing, but a powerful agent of change. While the results spoke loudly, Rogers himself remained humble and focused on the human element. In 1951, he published Client-Centered Therapy, a book that laid out his theories and methods, complete with transcripts of actual therapy conversations. Reading those dialogues, other therapists were struck by how different Rogers' tone was patient, non-authoritarian, and deeply validating of the client's feelings. Many found it inspiring. Others found it borderline simplistic. In one off-cited case from his writings, Rogers worked with a young woman he called Miss Munn, who was grappling with depression and self-doubt. Rather than dissect her past, Rogers helped her articulate her present feelings. Over months of sessions, she blossomed from a timid, self-critical person into someone who made her own decisions and voiced her needs. Rogers published a follow-up showing how her life tangibly improved as she took charge of her choices. Stories like this were persuasive. By the mid-1950s, word of Rogers' approach had spread beyond academia. Ordinary people in search of counseling began seeking out practitioners who would listen and support rather than prescribe. The cultural moment was ripe for Rogers' ideas. Post-war America was a society in flux, prosperity on the surface. But underneath, individuals were grappling with questions of identity, conformity, and emotional fulfillment in the face of rapid social change. Old authoritarian norms were being quietly questioned in many spheres, and Rogers' approach fit the zeitgeist by emphasizing individual autonomy and authenticity. In 1956, Time magazine featured Carl Rogers in a story, noting his maverick approach and calling the trend a revolution in talk therapy. No longer was counseling seen as only for the mentally ill or a secretive trip to the psychoanalyst's couch. It could be a constructive, even normal, process of personal growth. Rogers, with his calm Midwestern demeanor and lack of pretense, helped demystify psychotherapy. He showed it need not involve inscrutable theories or detached doctors. At its best, it was a compassionate dialogue between two human beings. Even as he gained recognition, Rogers was not without critics. Psychoanalysts sniffed that he was oversimplifying, ignoring the deep unconscious conflicts that only expert interpretation could unearth. Behaviorists thought his work lacked the rigorous control of variables. Where were the predictions, the quantifiable stimuli, and responses? And some in society at large viewed any form of psychotherapy with suspicion as an indulgence for the worried well. Rogers acknowledged these critiques. His method was not a panacea. It wouldn't cure severe mental illness overnight, nor was it meant to replace medical interventions when those were necessary. But he firmly believed, and increasingly had evidence, that even in cases of serious psychological distress, providing a relationship of acceptance and empathy could trigger improvements that no amount of coercion or cold technique could. By the late 1950s, Carl Rogers had become one of the leading voices of a burgeoning movement later known as humanistic psychology. In 1961, he published On Becoming a Person, a collection of essays and case studies that was both deeply philosophical and warmly personal. In its pages, Rogers articulated core concepts he had observed over decades, that people have a fundamental, actualizing tendency, an innate drive to grow, develop, and fulfill their potential, much like a plant leans towards sunlight, that psychological problems arise when this growth is stifled by conditions of worth imposed by others, for instance, only feeling valued if one earns certain grades or behaves in approved ways, and that the three key ingredients of a helping relationship are genuineness, The therapist being real and transparent, unconditional positive regard, non-judgmental caring, and empathic understanding. These ideas would become foundational in counseling training programs around the world. In those years, Rogers also began to extend his focus beyond one-on-one therapy. Ever the idealist, he wondered if the same principles that fostered personal growth could be applied to groups, even societies. He started facilitating encounter groups, sessions where a dozen or so strangers came together, often for days at a time, to communicate with candor and empathy under Rogers's gentle guidance. In these circles, emotions could run high as people dropped their social masks and spoke from the heart. Rogers reported astonishing transformations. Individuals who came in defensive and guarded sometimes left with tears of gratitude and new friendships, having experienced, perhaps for the first time, a community of total acceptance. By the mid-1960s, the encounter group movement was in full bloom, part of a larger cultural exploration of human potential. Rogers was cautiously pleased. He had always stressed that freedom must be balanced with responsibility and that not every unfiltered outpouring is constructive, but he recognized that something important was happening. People were hungry for real connection and authentic self-expression, and they were finding it not in traditional hierarchies or institutions, but in honest dialogue with one another. The tumult of the 1960s and 70s brought Carl Rogers new opportunities to test his approach on the world stage. He held workshops in South Africa during the final years of apartheid, quietly bringing Black and white participants together in dialogues that transcended fear and prejudice. He traveled to Northern Ireland during the height of the Troubles, facilitating small group meetings between Protestants and Catholics who had been taught to hate one another, and he watched as enemies gradually recognized each other's shared humanity through listening. Rogers even engaged in a series of exchanges with psychologists in the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War, finding common ground in the simple truth that a person is a person, regardless of culture or political system. His faith in the power of empathy was vindicated in microcosm after microcosm, though he was the first to admit it was no magic wand. Political and social conflicts obviously required structural solutions too. Still, these efforts earned him a nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize, a testament to the radical idea that fostering understanding could be as potent as any treaty. Not every attempt to apply his methods went smoothly. In the late 1950s, Rogers took a position at the University of Wisconsin to work with hospitalized psychiatric patients. There he collided with the traditional medical model of treatment. Many psychiatrists on staff doubted that empathy and talk could reach those lost in psychosis. They favored medication and authority. Rogers and his colleagues gave it their best, sitting with severely disturbed clients in an effort to find the person behind the illness. Some patients made unexpected gains, but institutional pressures and skepticism were heavy. After a few years, Rogers left Wisconsin, discouraged but not defeated. The experience reinforced his conviction that even in the hardest cases, the path forward lay in seeing the patient as a person, not a collection of symptoms. It also highlighted the wider clash underway in psychology, as some urged tighter control over behavior through conditioning and drugs. Rogers argued ever more fervently for the power of human freedom and understanding. Through it all, Rogers remained a fundamentally gentle revolutionary. Soft-spoken and unassuming, he did not cultivate a guru's image nor surround himself with dogma. In fact, he often turned down opportunities to be cast as a hero of the age. What he cared about was that the ideas lived on and continued to evolve. In the late 1970s and early 80s, already well into his 70s, he wrote about education, about personal power in organizations, even about aging and facing death with openness. He held that the principles of empathy and respect were not just therapy techniques, but a way of being that could enhance any human relationship between teachers and students, managers and employees, parents and children, even between groups in conflict. In 1987, at age 85, Carl Rogers passed away after surgery, leaving behind a legacy as quietly profound as the moment that veteran first realized he was truly heard. Rogers's life traced an arc from the conservative certainties of a farm boy's upbringing to the forefront of a humanistic revolution. He saw firsthand the struggle between forces of conditioning and conformity on one side, and the longing for freedom and authenticity on the other. In his own childhood, strict rules and conditional love had nearly smothered that longing. But through education and experience, Rogers found a way to champion the freedom he once barely dared to acknowledge. Not a wild, anarchic freedom, but a deeply personal freedom to feel and to choose one's path. He fought the mechanistic view of human beings with a disarming weapon, kindness grounded in understanding. Where others reduced therapy to technique or humans to data points, Rogers brought the conversation back to the human soul, unique, self-determining, and yearning for meaning. Today, the echoes of Carl Rogers's listening revolution are so widespread that they often go unnoticed. Whenever a counselor nods sympathetically and asks a client, "How do you feel about that?" rather than dictating what they should do, Rogers's influence is there. Whenever a teacher or a parent pauses to truly hear a young person's perspective instead of scolding, the spirit of Rogers lives on. Even modern therapeutic approaches that look very different on the surface carry forward his legacy of respecting the client's experience and autonomy. The idea that empathy can heal is now almost taken as common sense in the helping professions, but it was Rogers who gave it scientific credence and moral weight. He proved that treating someone with dignity and acceptance is not coddling. It can be transformative. Carl Rogers helped turn psychology's gaze from rats in mazes and patients on couches to real people in everyday struggle, people striving to grow. He was, in a sense, a gardener of the human spirit. He believed that, under the right conditions, warmth, acceptance, and honest understanding, individuals like plants will naturally move toward wholeness and vitality. That belief in the positive unfolding of life stands as a powerful counterpoint to views that see humans as merely products of their conditioning or prisoners of their unconscious conflicts. Rogers did not deny that we are shaped by our pasts or subject to forces beyond our control, but he insisted we are not defined by those forces alone. There is something within us that seeks freedom, that pushes toward meaning, that strives to become real and fully itself. In the end, Rogers's legacy is less about any specific technique and more about a way of relating, an ethos of profound respect for the individual. It asserts that empathy is not just a nicety, but a fundamental human need, as vital to the psyche as air and water are to the body. His work underscores a simple yet radical truth. When we are truly listened to and understood, we come alive. The struggle between freedom and conditioning, meaning and mechanism, continues in each generation of psychology and society. But thanks in part to Carl Rogers, countless individuals have felt the liberating power of being truly heard, and in that listening, found the courage to step out of the cages of their past and into the open air of their own possibility. In an era often seduced by the precision of science and the promise of technology, Rogers kept reminding the field of the art of being with another human. His revolution was not loud, but it was profound, a testament to the idea that truly listening to each other may be one of the most revolutionary acts of all.